any size company can convince any other size company that they're the best. It doesn't matter, like, if you're a startup trying to sell to British Petroleum or Apple, there is a pathway to do that. There's a way. So we did that.
Hey everyone, I'm Gary Fox and this is the Entrepreneur Experiment Podcast. Welcome. This week I'm chatting to Alan Coleman. Alan is the founder of Brightbill and now Sweeper. And we chat a huge amount about the resilience it takes to be an entrepreneur, especially in these times. So a lot of the entrepreneurs I'm talking to now, they're specifically picked because A, they have a great story, but also they have a lot to add around resilience and starting in a tough time. I do genuinely believe, and we talk about this a lot in the pod, that we're now experiencing one of the toughest times we'll ever experience in our lives, but also one of the best times for starting a business. Alan touches on this and explains his own journey through starting in the middle of the recession, and his advice is absolutely top class. So it's a great episode. If you want, you can also watch this episode on YouTube. We now have a YouTube channel specifically for the podcast. We also now have a Twitter and Instagram handle, so you'll get clips and extra bits and bobs about the podcast up there. So go and look at them on YouTube, subscribe. And we're also about to launch the book club on June 1st. So we'll announce what book we're going to read. So send me on your suggestions. What books are coming out? What books have you read in the last 6 months that you think would be great for other people to read? So we'll pick one book and we'll read it for the month of June. So I'm really looking forward to that one. I'm also in the middle of building out the member space for listeners and for guests where they can come on, share ideas, get feedback on ideas they're working on, and just create a community. Because at the start of this, I created a Google spreadsheet for entrepreneurs, for looking for mentors, to be a mentor for free software. And it got great traction on Twitter and across LinkedIn. A lot of people have been finding it very useful. So I want to build on that and build our own community for the Entrepreneur Experiment. We have a really active base of people who get in touch with me all the time and give me feedback about the episodes and the guests. So I want to formalize that and make that open to everybody. So that'll be coming in the next couple of weeks. The only way to join that is to go to my website, mrgaryfox.com, and join the email list. You'll then get notified of when the member space goes up. That is it for today. Here we go with this week's chat with Alan Coleman from Sweeper. Alan, welcome to the pod.
Thanks very much, Gary. Nice to be here.
I got to comment on that background, first of all.
Unfortunately, someone took it upon themselves to tell me that a BBC had different set backgrounds that you could, you know, freshen up your Zoom with, and I chose the TARDIS for today's call.
Nice. Yeah, it's a good home office fit. I got IKEA. Yeah. I think I might have to go see if I can get Old Trafford now for next week. That's brilliant. So, Alan, thank you so much for coming on. Just by coincidence, you actually wrote a brilliant article on LinkedIn yesterday, and we'd already arranged a chat, but it was something that I really found insightful. Do you want to just quickly kind of touch on that before we kick off?
Yeah, sure. I wrote a short piece just on really on kind of the mindset that people need to have in kind of times that are pretty turbulent, like the ones we're living through right now. And that I have found, like, I started my first company in 2009 in the teeth of like the financial recession. And it was challenging, but I guess my reflection on that is you couldn't let that overwhelm you. You sometimes have to ignore what's happening macroeconomically and look at the merits of what you're doing, you know, at a much more granular level. And you have to trust in the fact that if you have a good enough proposition or you're bringing innovation to the marketplace, that will solve for the other challenges. That there's always money there for if the idea is strong enough. So for existing entrepreneurs, there needs to be persistence. For new entrepreneurs, these moments are massive catalysts to change. Like, there's inflection points in history when everything gets reshaped. Like, it can be after a war, after a pandemic is another one. This is an opportunity when society and commerce and everything starts to re-question how they work. And then within that period of change, there's a much higher adoption of new technology, new ideas. And hence, it's a really good time to be starting new businesses or jumping on opportunities that you see. And then finally, for people who are sitting in businesses, business leaders who are making decisions, the temptation for some organizations is to pause and to freeze and to stop and to have to hold on to what you have. But now more than ever, you know, you have to manage your cash flow. But if you can do that while still aggressively pursuing innovation, those organizations tend to come out the best of periods of disruption like this. Apple and Google, and think of companies like, think of the companies that have emerged in the last 10 years that weren't there, like Snapchat, others. They all started around 2009, 2010 period, and they are billion-dollar companies based on aggressively pursuing their innovation. So that was really the kind of thrust of my article. My few words was like that bravery and, you know, and being fearless in how you pursue innovation and make decisions and keep going. That's what's required now. And there's no limitation on that quality. That isn't, you know, that's not being restricted, or, and it really starts from within, that people have to really believe and find the passion for what they're doing and pursue it and continue to pursue it, notwithstanding the fact that it's very turbulent.
Yeah, you've kind of nailed one of the main questions I wanted to ask you straight away. Back in 2009, so I believe the exact same, just to kind of get out there. I believe the exact same, that there will be unbelievable companies. I saw a tweet this morning. Some guy was like, oh, going to be the best stock in the next 20 years? And most of the replies were not created yet. You know, the companies are not even started yet. What is it? And you can kind of talk in your own story here about, you know, starting in the depths of recession. What is it of that mix of events and timing that creates such good companies out of bad times?
Well, I suppose it adds an additional filter to those that start. And by that, I mean, when the sun is shining and everybody's having a good time, it encourages everybody to have a crack, right? And it, you know, this seems like it's doable, and sure, look, what's the worst that could happen? When it's a really stormy day and it's really getting disrupted, that will deter certain people, because they're, oh, actually, you know what, now it feels like maybe that's not. And so that filter maybe means that the ones that get through are the ones that have like just an unwavering determination to pursue their vision or their innovation, or they have such belief in what they're doing. So it kind of sets the bar a little higher to jump in, to commit to that, right? So maybe to a certain extent, like, I wasn't cognizant of the environment 2009. The IMF were about to come into Ireland. Wasn't super cognizant. I was more dealing with the impacts of that on a day-to-day basis. Like, Enterprise Ireland weren't matching funding anymore. So I had to go through a big rigmarole of trying to find like 10,000s and 5,000s from people to try to cobble together an amount of seed money that would allow me to let the business live. But that just felt to me like that's just what I have to do. Like that wasn't a, oh Jesus, you know, I should stop. That was just what I had to do. And so I think that possibly kind of determines, you know, why those companies that start in that period. There are other kind of less impactful pieces, like you get better availability of talent because there's more people available in the workplace. You know, space is cheaper, and so there's aspects like that, but fundamentally, I think they are those factors don't influence as much as the direction and drive of the proprietor, of the person who's driving the business. And I think that's possibly why in these periods, it's the one people who work through this and have that extra bit of determination end up, you know, building the really great businesses.
So take me back to before you started in, was it 2008 or 2009?
I'll go further. I'll just give you a very quick pen of my career. Like I did a mediocre Leaving Cert, and then I had a choice between arts and science at the time. It shows you how things have changed. Science was like basically a notch above arts at the time for points for the Leaving Cert. So if you were socially inept, you chose science, and otherwise you chose arts, right? So I wasn't socially inept, but my dad kind of said, I think you should do science. You'll probably get something more of that. And I said, all right, fair enough, I'll do science. So I did a kind of general science degree specializing in computer science and maths.
Oh, wow.
At which I was, well, it sounds it, like, with retrospect, the aesthetic of that degree feel is probably the most powerful thing about it, because I didn't do a particularly good job at getting that degree.
I think that's all degrees, to be honest. I was thinking about that yesterday. I think that's every degree.
It's you choose your degree based on the impact of the words chosen to describe the degree, you know? But anyway, so I did that. I was kind of struggled through, but what I did manage to do was generate a way to develop relationships with people who were quite technical, and you know, I kind of got on with a bunch of my fellow classmates. But then I went on and did postgraduate in business, which I was better at and more to my aptitude. And then I ended up working as a business analyst for Morgan Stanley, the investment bank in London. And that put me in the mix of between technology and trading environment, and trying to match requirements to the technology that was being developed. And around 99, it was beginning, the dot-com was really bubbling to its crescendo. And I wanted to come back to Dublin. I had been in London and New York, and I was looking at a trading role. And then I saw a tech role in the paper, because that's where you saw jobs back then. That dates me. The advert in the paper, and it said this company wanted a business analyst with investment banking background to work in a tech startup. Tech startups were guaranteed untold wealth at that point, right? It was, you know, everybody throw a rock and everybody was a billionaire, right? And so I said, yeah, let's do that. So jumped in, joined a company called McCalla Software. And what's relevancy of that, of course, is that on the same day, Jim Hannon, my co-founder and current CTO, started in McCalla, right? And So with McCalla, they had a super talented team, like really, really good engineers. In fact, the CTO of McCalla, that at the time, one of the early employees there, is now worked with me in Brightville and works with me in Sweeper as well. So there's a cluster of people who you establish a relationship with and you kind of bring them with you through your career. But anyway, McCalla was, you know, it did pretty well. I would describe that... We built some amazing technology, but it struggled somewhat to find, to really nail the marketplace, the product market fit. And I sometimes describe it as a hammer factory. We made beautiful hammers, but we weren't sure what nails to hit.
What did they make, or what did they build?
I joined when it was described as CORBA-based financial frameworks, and CORBA being an early middleware technology. That Iona made famous based on building orbs and stuff like that. And when I left McCalla, I don't know what the tagline was exactly, but we were basically building solutions to remove paper scratch cards from prepaid top-up for mobile phones, linking banks to mobile operators to the phone. So that you could authorize debits and credits on the prepaid phone. So it was a circuitous path to find that opportunity. And in the middle of that, I was in New York on 9/11. I was there the day those planes hit.
Oh, wow.
I was in London when the bombs went off on the tube. So it was a real mad time in history, right? You know, dot-com... In 4 years, you had like the explosion of the dot-com bubble. You had global international terrorism kick off in a real way. And you had, you know, so the whole thing was, it was just a real maelstrom of different events, right? And then in 2002, I left McCalla because I was in London at this point. And McCalla was beginning to stutter a little bit, trying to figure out how it was going to progress. And I kind of felt like I wanted to change and I felt like I needed more stability. So I joined Accenture and I stayed at Accenture for 7 years, helping negotiate hardware and software deals on behalf of Accenture customers. So I got a big exposure to the commercial aspects of how software is monetized and how that works. But then that sort of heady cocktail of events and excitement that I had experienced in McCalla was always with me, and it drove me to question how much I enjoyed the kind of the dependable approach that Accenture offered, you know, the kind of steady career progression. And I kind of decided at that time that I wanted to, I really felt I wanted to be able to start my own company or do something myself. I wasn't sure what it was. But I started with that mindset. So by 2008, I had come up with this concept called what was launched as getitkeepit.com. But it took me 2 years of writing a business case and examining it and discussing it with friends and colleagues and trying to just determine whether this was had merit.
Was this while you were at Accenture?
This is while I was at Accenture, yeah, yeah. In fact, I had when I did formulate the business, we had our first board meeting in the boardroom of Accenture.
You started high anyway.
I said, like, we're going to set the standard here. This is the global boardroom. At the time, like, Accenture's global boardroom was Dublin, or is Dublin still. So we were in the boardroom of the global organization, nice, having our meeting about some copies at, you know, our startup.
It's like saying dress for where you want to be. I guess you were having the meetings for where you wanted to be.
Start as you mean to continue. Get It, Keep It was the name of the idea. It was a service to aggregate household bills in one dashboard for the households to help you manage incoming electronic bills, budgeting for them, paying them, all that sort of stuff. It was a classic two-sided marketplace type challenge where I had to build a brand to get consumers to adopt it. The more consumers I had, the more relevant I was to the service providers. And then I could monetize the relationship with the service providers by saying, I can get X thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of customers to adopt e-billing by virtue of the convenience of having everything in one place. But it's a total Venus flytrap of a startup idea, right? and it's funny, I say it's a Venus flytrap because even though evolution has not yet taught flies not to go into the Venus flytrap, evolution has not taught VCs not to back this business model.
But even when you were explaining it to me, I'm like, yeah, I like this.
I know. It's a honeypot. It's a classic honeypot. Right? Because it is exactly that challenge of that two-sided marketplace where you need you need critical mass on both sides in order to attract into something that is virally efficient. So it's no good me offering you a service that aggregates three of your eight household bills. So you want all eight in one place. And it's no good me saying to Vodafone, I have 5,000 customers paying for this service. They're saying, well, I have a million customers. Yeah. So anyway, we pivoted very quickly off that business model. So we said, this isn't going to work. We were running out of cash. We had no hope to... It was easy to see that we would just basically run into a brick wall.
Did you see that? So you were trying to fill up the utilities on one side and the customers on the other. So when did you see...
We started to see it like... You know, when I'm talking to startups now, I advise them, you need to set goals and milestones for the business. And you need to make sure they're realistic. And then the hardest thing you need to do is not give yourself a pass on missing those goals, right? Don't mitigate. Say, this month was tough because, we didn't do that well. So next month I'm going to, that's like the fallacy of the process, right? That you keep giving yourself a pass until it's too late to do anything when you eventually realize that there was fundamental problems or flaws in the business. So I was month to month giving myself passes because to put it in context, myself and Jim had left on career breaks from Accenture for me, RT for him. We both had mortgages. We both had kids. So this was a non-trivial decision. And he said, well, look, we'll be very firm at this. We'll give this a good crack for 6 months. But if we don't hit our milestones, at least we'll go back. We have that safety net of being able to go back into our work.
Okay. So you had planned that. You both had sat down and went, right, this is what we're going to do. Two career breaks.
Yeah, so we were kind of premeditated about how this would work. We got into this month-by-month scenario, and we could see like the consumers, the virality of the service, the ability for one person to benefit by virtue of bringing another person in. That's a fundamental requirement of any consumer business, like that if there's a service aspect to your offering, it has to be innately in the interest of the customer to have to attract more customers, right? Because if it's not, then it's going to be real hard yards to get to spend dollars to acquire each customer, unless you have a really efficient monetization, like super efficient. And we didn't have a super efficient monetization. We had a theoretical one. So anyway, we were kept figuring out that we were missing on our customer growth. We also began to look at the realities of what a corporate enterprise contract looked like. So it was incredibly slow to get a contract signed, even if you got them emotionally bought into the idea. And then when the contract was signed and procurement and others got involved, the cash payment terms were outrageous, like 90-day payment terms for a startup with no cash. Yeah. You know, it was just so evident that we could never make this work. And we weren't making enough growth on the consumer side to go back out looking for more venture money. Not that there was any venture money in Ireland available for dot-com consumer-facing businesses, right? So all of these things culminated into us going, this is never going to work. We have to stop. We have to do something different. And before we got to that point of saying, yeah, we should go back and kill this, we said, well, you know what we do know? We do know enterprise software. So where could we apply the technology that we've built such that we could monetize the software and not have to operate the business on top of the software? And so that's what we did. We became Brightbill. But even then, we chose the wrong market initially. We went after postal providers. We thought postal providers, they need this. They're the ones being disrupted by e-commerce and e-billing. All the transactional mail volume is going down the drain. Their revenues are declining. So they need to reinvent themselves using a digital platform, become this hub again for what we refer to as digital mail. The concept was it was a place other than your inbox where it was known recipients and known senders for important documentation. And that is still a kind of untapped opportunity, but it probably needs that whole, there's another hour of podcast on that whole business model as well. About how that requires to be a government-backed initiative in order to get the critical mass of material or correspondence into a single environment. But there's definitely opportunities that the technology has moved forward. So you can pre-process, you know, you can apply security to a medical invoice. You can pre-process and do household budgeting based on pending outgoing. You know, there's a whole workflow of help that could be done. That email is just a dumb recipient. It's just like, it's the equivalent of your mat in front of your letterbox. Stuff just falls on it. Your mat, there's nothing there apart from sit there and hold it, right? So technology is capable of opening all of those mails, figuring out, putting them in the right piles, you know, figuring out what any of these things mean for your calendar, your budget. But none of that happens. But that was the concept behind digital mail. Anyway, we ended up partnering with Accenture because they were looking at this space and thought there was an opportunity too. We went 18 months down that path, made some good progress, lots of pilots. But when it actually came to deploying this and it becoming a thing, all the postal boards basically felt it was like turkeys, asking turkeys to vote for Christmas. Yeah. Because they were saying, like, let me get this straight. You want me to invest in a platform that will accelerate the decline of my transactional mail, so I'm going to disrupt myself. And in the future, this digital platform will generate untold wealth for me. But initially, it'll start to, you know, undermine or accelerate my decline. And these guys sitting on boards were going, I earn a pension. I've got three more years. Yeah, they're like, nah, I'll write this one out.
By the time it came to paying off, those lads would be gone anyway. So it wasn't for them. Yeah.
So anyway, so look, we had to pivot a second time at that point and pivot back to the way the great thing about going on a journey is that you can look back and be a total revisionist about where it started and how clever you were. And I knew immediately and I jumped on that opportunity, but it never works out like that. Right. So I'm like, in my revisionist moment, what I would say to you, Gary, is that I knew there was a problem in billing. Initially, I thought it was the distribution of bills was the problem. And then I realized it was the efficacy of the bill. The bill is a communication. And if I could improve the way the bill was designed and looked and improve customer comprehension, then I could make a real impact on the behavioral impacts of a bill. And that's kind of where Brightbill ended up. Brightbill ended up being focusing on the composition of the bill and realizing that if you composed a bill in an easier, friendlier, more intuitive way, that you got amazing customer behavioral changes. People stopped calling the call center with questions about the bill. People felt better about your brand and didn't churn away from your service as much. People paid you more often on time. And when you started to calculate the impact of that behavioral change, you realized that it was a huge problem marketplace. Like, I could save postage and stamps on the distribution problem. I could say, which is like a, say a euro, I could save 10 euro by getting behavioral change from customers that felt the bill now was a fair representation of what they had consumed from that service provider. So that's where Brightbill ended up. We ended up being that in that space.
How did you keep going though? Because you had your initial 6 months and then I think you said 18 more months. So how mentally and financially also as well, if you want to discuss that, how did you keep going past the 6 months? And you talked about kind of letting yourself slide on goals. How did you keep going through that time? Because I think that's the crunch point that probably people are in now, maybe, and people will be in 6 and 12 months when suddenly they don't realize it takes longer than 6 months to become a billionaire.
There's a great documentary called Touching the Void, and it's about two mountaineers
who went climbing this
very distant peak in Peru, and one of, they came get into trouble on their way down the mountain, and one of the guys falls, breaks his leg. And he then needs his pal to lower him down the mountain. So they would, you know, he would slide down the mountain, dig in, his pal would climb down, and then he would just do this kind of looping effect. All working well until one person, the able-bodied guy, lowered the guy with the broken leg off a cliff in the middle of the night and didn't know it. He just felt the line go taut, right? And your man wasn't signaling him to climb down. He was just taut. And eventually he started to figure out that he must have lowered him off a cliff edge or something, because he was being dragged off the mountain himself because he was sliding. So he takes this horrific decision to have to cut the rope. And he cuts the rope and his friend falls off the side of the mountain into a ravine and onto a snowbank, which breaks his fall. It's a pretty big fall, but it didn't kill him. So he was conscious. His friend thinks his mate's dead and goes off home. I'm ruining the movie for anyone who wants to watch it.
Okay, spoiler alert. I'll put a spoiler alert to start, don't worry.
but the key thing about these two, this is a real story, and these two guys existed and this happened. And the guy who was broken leg, fallen outside of a mountain in a ravine, which meant he couldn't be seen from the surface because he'd fallen through a crevasse on a bank, and below him is pitch black, nothing to be seen, cannot see a thing. Above him is something he can't get to. He can't get to the surface. And he made a decision to throw himself into the blackness because he couldn't figure out how to do it. And he landed on a much gentler incline that allowed him to crawl all the way back to the top. And eventually he crawled back and to his base camp, right? It's a harrowing story, but it's amazing. But then the guys reflected, as you do with these events, they tried to kind of distill some life lesson from it. And the life lesson that he has, you can never stop making decisions. You have to make decisions. The worst decision is a non-decision. And when you're in the middle of a business, when stuff is failing and ideas aren't working, and you've got to keep positively making decisions. Like, staying still and waiting for the world to change towards you is kind of typically a foolish position to be in. You have to proactively, you know, take decisions and keep trying and moving forward with different stuff, right? And that is fundamentally how we got through. We got through because I couldn't deal with failure. I couldn't deal with like it being over and having to go back in. Maybe it was like something in me that I just couldn't deal with it. That was worse. That was the worst outcome here. So I kept being determined and making decisions and trying to go forward. And I think, you know, with the team, like we all had a similar mindset that we were, you know, when you're in hell, keep walking, right? So that's kind of how we did it. So emotionally, and that's how we got through it. Financially, we were also blessed, right? We had some luck, right? Because if you track the way we fundraised, We didn't raise that much money relatively as a business. We raised about 5 million over the whole journey, but our fundraising dropped just before we did our two pivots. So we raised our first institutional money, about 1 million from NCB at the time in 2010, when we were describing the world as being a cloud-based billing platform. By February, we were all in on postal. So we pivoted away from what we told our investors and went towards postal, and went all the way into 2012, raised again on the strength of the postal and the traction we were going. But within 2 or 3 months post-raising that round, realized postal was never going to happen for us and pivoted again. So there was definitely some fortune in the timing of our shifts. And that talks to a little bit to how VCs always talk about, you know, you back a team. Like, and I suppose it's true to say we were resilient and we were capable. And the resilience and the capabilities allowed us to recognize not to keep doing the same thing and to do something different and to go after and have the ability and to go after the new thing, right? And so that's kind of how it worked out for us.
How did you, you made an interesting point there that the fundraising changed, then you pivoted away so the investors had invested in something else. How did you bring them on that journey with you? Because you kind of sold them on something else. What was it that you were able to say to them, go, look, this is what we're doing now? And you kind of touched on it there in terms of backing the team, but what was that? How did you bring them with you?
Yeah, that is the task, right? So any VC worth their salt recognize that businesses can go on quite varied journeys to get to an end point. And in fact, I would say, without speaking for them, that they hope that they invest in people who have the ability to not believe their own bullshit too much, right? And you can step back and be objective and say, actually, this isn't going to work. We need to do something different, right? Yeah. So in aggregate, they're looking at a marketplace. It's a big marketplace, and is there a big problem in here to be solved? Now, the team think they're going to solve it this way, but I think that team are good enough that even if it isn't that way they solve it, they'll figure out another way to solve maybe a different problem, but within this marketplace. So you're kind of laying bets on big marketplace, capable team, and everything in the middle is fungible. Now, that doesn't mean you rock up to the next board meeting and go, guess what? We're doing this. Off, you know, there has to be a logic and rationale. And you have to be, if you can't explain it to the board as to why you're doing what you're going to do, if you're just saying, oh, that's not working, I'm just going to give something else a crack. If that's the merit of your idea, then clearly that's not going to be well received. But if you do genuinely, and you can draw a line and you can bring people on the journey with you, then people, your good investors are all ears and will back you.
That's brilliant. I think that's such a, you've explained it incredibly well there in terms of, you know, you're in the right area, you know, you've got the right team and you're traveling through this kind of right direction. It's not like you're going off and going, oh, we're in fitness now. You know, we spotted this other idea. You're refining. It's the feedback loop, isn't it? You know, you're trying.
Exactly.
Failing, exactly. Refining. Try again. Yeah. I think that's a really good explanation. So the second pivot, what happened then?
The second pivot was we pivoted to focus on away from the distribution challenge with postal and more towards the design of the bill. And so we, you know, built a team to allow us to build, we built an internal design team. So this is the other aspect that we did well, I think, in Brightbill, is that we recognized that technology in and of itself wasn't a sustainable differentiator, and that the problem space was bills looked terrible. And because they looked terrible, they drove confusion, which drove cost. We said, which marketplace does the complexity of the bill translate to the most cost to the operators? To the service provider, and the answer was telecom operators and cable operators, because the complexity of the products and the billing had it correlated to a huge operational overhead that they were paying. An example of one US carrier that was a customer of ours was spending $500 million a year in receiving calls about their bill. So every month they send a bill out, and a percentage of their customers ring up and say, I don't understand this. And each time they called, it dropped roughly $10 of operational cost to that business.
Wow.
And so they said, $500 million a year just answering questions about the bill. And when we went in and redesigned the bill, which is both a technology problem and a design problem. The technology problem is you have to be able to acquire data that's in very locked away sort of proprietary systems. And you have to be able to gather all together, break it back down to its constituent parts and reshape it in the likeness of the bill that you want to send. So there was definitely some technology challenges here that we built and did. But the emphasis of the business was all about the efficacy of the design, about how the tonality, the font, the color, the way in which information was organized around the page, the information architecture, behavioral science about the choice of words you used. So we became experts in that area as it related to billing. And that was predominantly what we sold. We didn't sell, you want to see how great our tech is. We said, look how your bill looks awful. Look how beautiful and well-designed this one looks. This one's going to have a big impact. Mm. And by virtue of being able to do that, in the first year of that company that was spending $500 million a year in billing queries, they saved $50 million in the first year.
Wow.
Of deploying Brightbill. So, you know, I think there's echoes of that in how I built Sweeper. Again, looking at a problem, but trying to tackle it in a very multidisciplinary way. Like fundamentally, we're building software. The software is informed by multidisciplines to give effect to a customer experience. So the customer experience is what we're trying to build, not the technology, not the software platform, and not any kind of design framework. It's a customer experience. But all of those things, to bake a customer experience, you need to mix lots of things together, right? And any company that says, I'm just building a tech, you know, that linear technology play, that's too easily disrupted and it's too easily replicated, right? So I think that's an important aspect of creating a difference in how you build your problem, your company.
And how, so after, surely that's, that case study alone was the tipping point, or what point did you kind of go, you know what, this pivot has actually worked?
Yeah, no, it happened quite quickly. We won one, so I won a couple of deals in Europe, smaller deals, like hundreds of thousands of euro. But then we went after, actually it was interesting. A guy came to me who's based in San Francisco. And he was a contact of another person I knew, and he was looking for a job to be a rep for the US or North America. And I was like, no, we're not ready for that. We haven't funded for it. We're not ready for it. And he said, well, look, if you don't do it now, by the time you decide to do it, it'll take you 18 months after you decide to do it to ramp it up to get it done. I was like, oh yeah, maybe. So, and he said, look, I'll come on. I'll do it I'll earn whatever I can sell, kind of thing, right? Or we came to some arrangement whereby it was like totally low investment.
Good salesman. Sold himself first.
Yeah, he did. He sold himself first. So he came on, but that put my mind towards North America. So then I started to travel over, and I went to Canada, and I went to Enterprise Ireland because I didn't know anybody in the Canadian market. But Enterprise Ireland were able to connect me to one or two people with Irish linkages in their big telco, Rogers, which was like one of the top three in the country. Anyway, we ended up taking 18 months to sell a deal to Rogers. We bid against every other company bidding in the RFP that was sent out, had at least $1 billion on their balance sheet.
Wow.
And the contract was to be responsible for presenting, I think it was 10 billion Canadian dollars of build value that Rogers build on an annual basis. Okay. And the task was for a presentation layer for that bill. Despite the fact that we were probably 25 people based in Dublin with no one in North America, with a balance sheet that was laughable, we won that contract. And it was worth $15 million.
Wow.
To us. And it was like, it took a lot of lobbying and a lot of like there's a lot to how we sold that deal to overcome all the risks and perceptions about us being a small company that were, in retrospect, really good, but it was really tooth and nail fighting. But it did show me that any size company can convince any other size company that they're the best. It doesn't matter, like, if you're a startup trying to sell to British Petroleum or Apple, there is a pathway to do that. There's a way, right? So we did that. We managed to sell this deal to Rogers. Rogers chose us, and they chose us because they backed the innovation. They said, everybody else, all these other companies are talking about spool sizes. Like, they're all talking about how they do the thing we do today incrementally better. Mm. We were saying, this is how you fundamentally change your perspective on this, on the whole act of just creating and distributing a bill. And because we fundamentally are changing the way it works, it will fundamentally change the economics of the costs associated with it. And because of that, we charge them 10 times more than our nearest competitor.
Wow. Okay.
So we won. So, and that's another big point I always make. Never, an innovative company, an innovative startup should never compete on price.
And that's right? The mistake I think everyone makes. Everyone tries to be a little bit cheaper than the established guy, but so you're 10 times more expensive.
We were 10 times more expensive than our nearest bidder. And we still won. Because by the time it came to procurement, they weren't telling procurement, go buy me a platform that presents bills. They said, go buy me Brightbill. Right. Amazing. And I knew that. And therefore, they'd come in and laugh at us on our pricing and tell us we were on crack and that kind of thing. And we say, well, look, if you can't afford it, you can't afford it. I totally understand.
You've got to ask the price, you can't afford it.
But anyway, I mean, but in all cases, when people deployed the platform, it did deliver. It did generate a business case that justified the pricing.
Yeah, I think that's the difference as well. It's pricing high is one thing, but pricing high and then being able to back it up with real figures is the secret sauce, I think, to a lot of great businesses. So was that the moment where you kind of like sat back and was like,
Well, I mean, it was a bit of a, like, it was clearly very gratifying, and we had other pipeline. But what ended up being is we were whale hunting. It turned out that business was a whale hunting business. You had to go after the people with the biggest problem, and you had to take a long time to sell to them, which meant that your pipeline was basically one deal a year that you were looking for. You know, you were looking to land, you know, the mother load every year, which meant if you didn't land it, it was, you know, it was damaging, right? So we won Rogers. We won another deal in Sprint in the US then. We won Comcast. We won another deal with T-Mobile. And each of those deals were getting slightly bigger. And, you know, but it also, we were, as soon as you won the first in North America, it was the reference point. And then Rogers, clearly not wanting to look foolish, were more than happy to tell everybody, those guys are money.
That was going to be my next question. Is there a social proof aspect whereby if you do land that big whale?
Yeah, no, it's 100% social proofing, like, involved in that, right? So that, now, it's kind of funny, like, there's an initial bit, like, where it's, I want exclusivity. Only I want this.
Okay.
And then once you kind of negotiate off the table, it says, sell it to someone else so don't look like a fool if this thing goes wrong, you know? We talk out of both sides of our mouth.
Yeah. So you, that strategy then was North America. So what stage of the journey are we at now?
So that was, I think we closed that deal in 2013, 2014 timeframe. And then, so then the business kind of began to go. It was very cash generative. The other thing about the business that was a challenge, well, it wasn't really a challenge, but it was an aspect of the business. None of the buyers wanted OPEX models. They didn't want SaaS-based models. This was a strategic platform that they needed to own the software. They couldn't have the idea of it being a rental-based model, right? Because it was so fundamental to the way in which they charge for their business, which is a total double-edged sword. And this is something that doesn't get enough airtime. That business generated big influxes of cash into our business, which meant we didn't need any venture capital, which meant theoretically. Now, at the time we'd raised, you know, our 3 or 4 million, I think probably in investment. And it had been expensive enough. The valuations we were getting weren't super because the business wasn't really there yet. By the time we landed Rogers, we didn't need any more money because at that point forward, all of our deals were ending up with people writing us millions of dollars in checks for licenses and then lower recurring maintenance. So it meant that the business became very cash generative. So, but it also meant that we didn't have elongated cash flow that we could look into the future and say we're, you know, 5 years, we know we're like 60% of the cash flow. So the whole financial industry wants verified, repeatable, forecastable cash flow. And the whole industry is set up to fund and invest to get that cash flow, right? So VCs, there's kind of a self-fulfilling aspect to this. VCs want to back companies that have SaaS-based models. And but the more of a SaaS-based model you have, the more punitive it is in your cash flow, which means the more external capital you need, which means the more dilution you get on your journey, right? If you have a perpetual license model, you need less external capital over time, which means you get to hold more ownership of your cap table, which means at the end, you either get a high multiple on revenue, which you own a little smaller part of the business, or you get a lower multiple on revenue, but you own more of the business. And who's to say that which number ends up being the biggest number for the entrepreneur, right? So like VCs want cash flow because that gets them to put more money to work. Like there's a kind of SaaS suits the idea that they can get more cash into innovative cap tables more quickly. Perpetual license, you could argue, is more in the interest of the founder because they get to hold on to more of their company and fund their business out of the cash from receipts. So
that's so interesting because no one even brings that up. You just said it. Like even you were saying, I was like, I haven't heard someone talk about licenses in years. Like the MRR, the monthly recurring revenue, that's the goal. Get to your monthly recurring revenue.
Exactly.
It's never talked about.
It is never talked about. Like, and I think it, like for founders, it's something to think. It is something to think about. Now in Sweeper, we are trying to build recurring flows into our, but we're also trying to listen to how the market wants to buy. But at least we're cognizant of the implications of the decision. If I do decide to charge somebody on a recurring basis, I'm cognizant of what the relatively meager cash flow impact that has. And I'm cognizant of the fact that that means I have a dependency on external financing. So it's, you know, it's a multifaceted problem that needs looking at, and different businesses will make different decisions. And I'm not saying one is right and one is wrong, but you need to be at least aware of the option.
Yeah, to be honest, I hadn't even thought about it in years. It's only when you said it there. I guess you don't know what you don't know. If you're a SaaS business, you've always been that way and you've always charged monthly, then that's how you assume the world is, you know?
Yeah.
So take us up then to the Brightbill story, how you got to where you're now, I guess. How did you end up selling Brightbill?
So we sold Brightbill in 2016. We had built the business. We were targeting towards maybe 20 million revenue that year. We were coming off a trailing revenue number of about 11, I think. And we started to get some inbound interest, and it started to kind of, you know, pose the question to us, like, where are we going with this and when is the right time? We've been doing it for 6 years, which isn't that long, actually, relatively speaking. But anyway, we kind of, as a board, set a number that we thought, look, if someone came in and offered us this much, that would probably be a deal that balanced the opportunity of continuing to grow versus the risk of continuing to grow, right? So, you know, you always want to try and sell a business where, as the founder, you can sort of begin to see the crest of the hill, right? For you. Now, the crest of the hill for another purchaser might be higher because they can do more with the asset, right? Mm. But for us, we could see the crest of the hill. We were winning all these North American deals. We'd won most of the biggest ones. Our biggest competitor, who turned out to be our acquirer, was starting to become very commercially aggressive on pricing, like zero, because they had a much bigger business doing much different things.
Right.
And they could afford to basically subsidize a deal to lock us out with the rest of the business they did. So we were beginning to see that behavior come up. And all of those things kind of put into the pot. And we said, look, the execution risk of continuing in the market where we are, or going into different geographies or going into different verticals, seems like it's not trivial. This is the number we think balances that risk for an exit. And so then we sort of then got bankers and we started to solicit interest and ultimately generated a process that ended up in us exiting the business. And everybody who sold was entirely happy. It worked well. The investors did very well. The founders, everybody did. It was a good exit, and it was the right exit. You don't look back and say, "I wish I'd held on to it," or "I wish it." You know, it was a clean break. And even the acquirer built a really nice business and continues to. They grew the business from having 80 people to 200 people, and I think it's doing 50 or 60 million now as part of a division of that bigger business. So they did well with the acquired part of the business. So it was a good, clean exit. We did know, however, at that point that we didn't, we didn't really want to work in a bigger business. So after a period of time when we had transitioned Brightbill to the new acquirer, we started thinking about, other ideas, other concepts, other things we could do. And then that's kind of how Sweeper came.
How does that happen? I think that's interesting for a lot of people. When you do sell a business, how do you go with it? You know, do you negotiate, okay, I'm going to stay for 6 months, 3 months, 12 months? How does that work?
So typically the acquirer, it depends on the acquirer a lot as to how confident they are in the business plan they have for the business they're acquiring, right? And sometimes the business will say, this is, accretive to what we do naturally. We know how to run these kind of businesses. We don't need too much of your time. So, you can, whatever you feel comfortable. With us, they were quite keen for us to stay. Not because they didn't know how to run the business, but because I think they thought we were, we had a good vision and we were good at selling. But also there was a duty of care to the employees. I wanted to make sure that everybody working in Brightbill, felt settled in the new environment as much as they could. It's always a change. And sometimes an acquiring company is not the right fit for some people. And they want to move on anyway, because 100% is a different dynamic of working in a large corporate than working in a startup. But other people love it because they're like, it's the kind of innovation matched with the stability. So they love that working environment. So just different types of people. So you spend time transitioning so the customers feel like the company's ethos and approach hasn't changed, that the employees feel like, they understand what the new setting is. And then at that point and it's also a little bit about yourself, what's right for you. So you try to factor in other people's needs and wants, and you factor in your own needs and wants, and then you come to an agreement. And sometimes that's enshrined in what they call an earnout, where they put some of the principle that you're due because of the sale in escrow until you spend a period of time with them. Or sometimes there's no earnout, it's just a transition period.
Mm. And then you knew kind of straight away you were going to be looking at something new. Had you something cooking in the back of your mind, or you're like, I'm going to take a bit of time off and think about it?
No, I had something cooking in the back of my mind.
Good entrepreneurs always do.
Yeah, it was a kind of combination of a couple of things. It was a combination of wanting to build on the assets that we had created with Brightbill. And by assets, I mean relationships with customers, relationships with talent, relationships with capital, right? So using that as foundation to go do something, wanting to have another crack at something and doing it slightly differently than the way you did it when you were making it up as you went along. And now you understand a few bits and pieces that, that's do that, don't do this. But then also, I suppose there's something in me that says, when I see a problem or I have an experience that underwhelms me, I do find myself questioning why does the world work that way? And I had a few incidents with technical support in my house, and it was hard. And I thought it was relatively technically exclusive. It demanded a certain technical knowledge to resolve the issue. And I couldn't rationalize how a non-technical person could work through the same issue. And then I also was aware of the emerging explosion of connectivity and dependency on connections. And I said, like, this ringing of call centers is never going to work. And the self-care models that are out there right now are all insufficient because they just are capturing intent or need. They're not actively resolving. They're not actively initiating the fix, right? To the greater. And that's where I thought Sweeper had the opportunity. I said, you need to create something that takes the best aspects of a call center engagement and automate those things. And the two things are access to diagnostics, looking at the house and looking at the health of the connected devices and the environment, and communication pathways that are suitable for people of different technical competency. And so those are the two hallmarks of what the Sweeper is. Sweeper is, it moves the point, we'll call it moving the point of triage from sitting within a call center at the end of a phone and a wait and everything else to being within your home.
Okay.
With no latency. And as soon as you can tap it into a chatbot or you can speak it to Alexa or Google Assistant and say, what's wrong with Netflix? Why is the game so slow?
Yeah. And from someone that, who's never heard of Sweeper, what exactly does it do to the man on the street? What does it do?
It's technical support in your home, right? So that's the simplest way to describe it. Like, it's just the thing you would say to an agent is the thing you'll now say or type within your home and have the exact same outcome, right? With no waiting. So take Air, for example. A large percentage of broadband issues they have are to do with something called sync, which is just the router and their servers coming out of sync. And right now, like, to initiate that resync, you have to call them but all the time waiting to talk to them, and the action and the questions they'll ask you and the actions they'll take are all automatable. So that's an example of a challenge where you can make, like, globally, it depends, but roughly 50 to 70% of all tech support calls are resolved on the first call remotely.
Wow.
Which means either an action was taken or the customer was educated or some instructional information was given. And so that's what Sweeper is targeting.
Where are you now in the Sweeper journey?
So Sweeper, we passed our Series A. So we raised seed, raised Series A, luckily enough, towards the end of last year, which gives us good runway to continue to build over the next 18, 24 months. We are about 32 people, split between Dublin, Madrid, and the US, selling to CSPs and also large appliance manufacturers. And we also attracted Amazon, the Amazon Alexa Fund, as a funder of Sweeper as well, because of this use case of voice and support. And they're seeing that as being a real compelling use case for voice assistants. So, yeah, so, I mean, the business is, we're at that kind of, you know, it's still hand-to-hand fighting. Like, we don't feel the wind beneath our wings just yet. But yeah, no, we're in a good place. We have, I think, the relevancy of our vision for support has never been, you know, more evident than it is today as we live through this kind of global confinement and pandemic. We have a lot of work ahead of us. We have a lot to take what we are, where we are now in terms of the assets, the software, the people, the opportunity, and execute this plan such that we can probably, I think, get to Series B, which will be the next big milestone for the business, which will be to say we've accumulated enough evidence, both in terms of financial performance and traction and deployment, that suggests that we're going to be one of the winning entities, you know, in this market as it reshapes. And that'll be the basis upon which we'll try to raise Series B.
You've picked another massive market as well.
Yeah, no, it is huge. And but, you know, that's a good thing, right? It's a lot of money being spent in this way. These markets always will, you know, transform and change. And yeah, and I think, you know, customer experience is at the heart of it, right? So don't think about it as a massive market. Think about it as an individual interaction. Think about it, you know, think of the last time you had to call a call center rep and ask a question, and how seamless was the entire experience from firstly recognizing you had a problem to establishing how you ask for help to getting the help you need and having the problem fully resolved. Like, there's so many examples of where the experience from start to finish is just poor. And it's important. Like, it's not just an inconvenience to you, but that paucity of experience translates to needless operational expenditure on behalf of the provider. Like just you're upset, they're upset.
I will do anything to try to figure something out before I'll call customer service. So I am sold. I'm in. Like, I think everyone's the same. Like, I will Google for 2 hours.
But there is also there's a bit of a selection bias in that we're technical, right? We're naturally comfortable with a lot of the technologies and how they all work. But there's a huge cohort of the population who are also consumers of broadband and technology who do not live in this world.
Yeah.
And when something goes wrong, it's like staring into a well. They have no clue what's going on. All they know to do is ring. But actually, if we can get more of those people to have confidence that there's a different pathway and it's not intimidating and it's not going to show them up for not knowing certain things,
yeah,
and it's going to resolve the problem way quicker, then that's the target audience. That if we can make an impact in that community, then we'll be successful.
I love it. Listen, Alan, I'm going to let you go. One question before we go. I ask everyone to recommend a book that's had an impact on them or helped them in some way. Do you have a book that you recommend?
I do. Coincidentally, I have a book on my desk, and the book I'm reading at the moment is called The Future of Capitalism by Paul Collier.
Okay.
And the book is really interesting. It's not super light reading, but it's, if you dip in every so often, it's pretty decent. It really talks to the dichotomy of society and how, you know, there's an educated, liberal, kind of metropolitan-based environment, middle class, you know, understands the world in a certain way. And then there's a different part of society that is less financially secure, less well-educated. And when you apply all the different kind of castes of, you know, nationality and race and everything else across those two layers, but fundamentally the split between those two things is a guaranteed recipe for the sort of turbulence we see and populism we see in the world today. So it's and he's espousing things like basic minimal wage and different strategies to try to, you know, make society feel a lot fairer. So I find that interesting.
And it's never been more apparent than during COVID. Alan, where can people learn a little bit more about Sweeper?
Sweeper.com, SWEEPOR.com. It's lots of blog posts and stuff in there. If you're interested in the topic, lots of things to read. That's probably the best place.
And where's the best place to reach yourself in terms of following your own journey?
Probably on LinkedIn, if I'm honest. I'm a voyeur on Twitter. I don't really do anything. I just read stuff. LinkedIn is probably where I'm most active in terms of sharing my thoughts.
Perfect. Listen, Alan, thank you so much. I appreciate you coming on the podcast.
Okay. Thanks, Gary.
Talk to you soon.
Nice talking to you. Cheers. Bye-bye.
And that was this week's episode of The Entrepreneur Experiment. Thank you again so much for joining us. To win the copy of the book that Alan chatted about there, simply tag me on social media and Sweeper. Share it across Instagram, Twitter, wherever you like. Just make sure you do tag me to be in a chance to win. I will see you next Thursday at 6 a.m. Be safe, be well.